Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back for another wonderful episode of Time for Forgiveness. And I am Robert Pascuzzi, and I'm joined here by my wife, Kelly. And today we have a very interesting and exciting guest on, Everett Worthington. And I know you're all going to be very fascinated with Ev. We're going to refer to Everett as Ev. And Ev's story and his journey and what he's done with his life, it's remarkable. So, Ev, welcome into Time for Forgiveness today.
Yeah, Bob, it's good to be on with you and Kelly.
We're so excited to dive into this conversation because I believe there's really no more important conversation than forgiveness because of the impact it has in all of our lives.
Yes, and so I'm going to just kind of get the ball rolling by reading you Ev's bio. So here we go. Everett Worthington is a Commonwealth Professor Emeritus. His research and writing focus on forgiveness and other virtues, religion and spirituality, and issues related to marriage and family. His mission is to help individuals, every heart, couples and families, every home, and even communities and countries, every homeland, forgive. Everett was counseling couples professionally in the mid-1980s when he first became interested in the concept of forgiveness, and he began studying the topic significantly in 1990. After the murder of his mother in 1996, Everett began thinking about how the practice of forgiveness relates to justice, faith, and virtue, a main theme of his recent work. While he forgave the murderer, as did his brother and sister, the emotional fallout was devastating, and in 2005, his brother committed suicide. In addition to studying forgiveness of others, Everett drew on his own feelings of guilt and self-condemnation and added the study of self-forgiveness to his interests. All right, Ev, again, welcome in. We're just really jazzed to have you on today. And I think we just wanted to kind of dive in here. And I know you've got a lot that you probably want to touch on. Kelly, you okay if I roll with the first question here? I had to do that, Ev. All right.
Okay, I'm going to take the first question, actually.
There we go.
She just gave me the look, Ev.
I think what really caught my attention was when I was reading your life mission, and it said to do all I can to promote forgiveness in every willing heart, home and homeland. The word willing really caught my attention. And I'm just curious, in regards to all your study and research, how do you believe a person becomes willing? Because not everybody is.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that the really interesting thing that we've found in like 30 some years of research on this is that forgiveness doesn't have to do all the heavy lifting. There are a lot of really good ways that are, you know, biblically consistent that people can deal with injustices in their life. So things like turning it over to God or pursuing justice or forbearing or accepting and moving on. So lots of different alternatives to forgiveness. So even if a person is not willing to forgive, they have a lot of options to still deal with forgiveness in a way that is honoring to their faith. So, but how do people become willing? There are many ways, many, you know, kind of paths to becoming a willing forgiver. It could be that their religious beliefs, practices, and values drive them that way. It could be that they just get fed up with carrying around resentment and bitterness and, you know, and hostility toward people, and they want to do something to, you know, to get past that. It could be that they find out that there actually are a lot of benefits to the forgiver. There are benefits, of course, to the relationship and benefits to the person being forgiven, but there are mental health and physical health and relational and spiritual benefits to the person who forgives. So there are lots of different motives that can be turned on as people delve into wrestling with their own unforgiveness.
Well, I'm curious. Obviously, you've had many opportunities in your life to really experience and practice this thing we call forgiveness. And how were you automatically a willing participant with that? Or you just mentioned different options. What resonated with you?
Well, I, as a Christian, I, you know, valued forgiveness and had a lot of beliefs in how important that was and how God could help me to forgive. So that was personally important in my faith. But I also was I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and at one point I was doing a lot of part-time private practice counseling couples. And you don't have to counsel many couples before you find out that forgiveness almost always is some kind of issue.
Sure.
and needs to be resolved before counseling ends. And so to see the power that forgiveness had to transform the relationships of couples was something that drew me also. So there just were a lot of, you know, a lot of different draws for me personally. I would have to say that in terms of studying forgiveness scientifically, it basically was my graduate students that made me do it. I hate to blame my graduate students on this, but I do anyway. I did a little clinical article on helping couples forgive, and a young man, Mike McCullough, showed up to join my research team and be a doctoral student at Virginia Commonwealth University. And Mike wanted to study forgiveness. And so I didn't know anything about it. It was something that people were not researching. I'd written about it clinically a number of times, but not from a research standpoint. So, so Mike would go over to the library and find these obscure, you know, 1960 article on a therapist reflecting on forgiveness. And he would come back and summarize it for me. Excuse me just a second. I'll have to edit that out. So Mike would come back and he would have this article, this obscure article, and you know, he would be covered with dust from having been in the stacks. And that was back when we had to go to the stacks, you know, to find these articles. Anyway, I would sit and listen to his summary and stroke my beard in a wise way, pretending that I understood exactly what he was talking about. And turns out, you know, I didn't. And so that meant I had to go over and dig out those articles and learn. Mm-hmm. So Mike was the first graduate student, and then right after him, Steve Sandage joined, and he had an interest in forgiveness, but he had a different perspective. He was more psychoanalytic, where Mike was more social psychological. And then right after that, Jennifer Ripley joined, and she was more interested in forgiveness in couples. By that time, I was making like three independent trips to the library to keep up with these bright graduate students. So, you know, finally I just decided, hey, you know, I better learn this stuff myself. And so
that's what really sparked your, that really spark your interest then into forgiveness was, you know, the interactions that you had with Mike and Steve and then Jennifer. Is that kind of what got it going for you then? Or was it really more working with couples before that? I mean, something got you really diving deep into this.
Well, you know, it's kind of a combination in that it was my part of my Christian value system and my personal practice of forgiveness. So that was important and as kind of the bedrock background. And then working with couples and seeing it, that just added on to it. And then, you know, getting into, well, hey, we could study this by using research methods. And, you know, and we started right away with Mike doing my empirical research on it. And all of those things really are different, mm-hmm. kind of different facets of the diamond, you know, where you're looking at one side and then the other and then the other and seeing kind of different sparkles in right. from each point of view.
Well, it's like what Wayne Dyer used to say, change the way you look at something and what you look at changes, right? But, you know, going back to your research then around forgiveness, what findings or results have, did anything that you researched surprise you or, you know, things that you discovered about it because it was inherent in who you were as an individual and, but as you got more into this, what did surprise you the most about your findings?
Yeah, I think there have been quite a number of things that I'm not sure surprised, but things that we didn't know that came out of the research. You know, from a Christian standpoint, we know we can look at verses on forgiveness, and we find that almost all of the verses are basically, you need to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't tell you how, you know, there's no, how do you do this? And forgiveness is treated as like, okay, do this, this is good. And so things that have come out of the scientific study, which really complement the Christian teachings on forgiveness, you know, they expand on it. They're consistent with the Christian teachings, but they tell us things that the scriptures don't tell us, or even, you know, historic Christian practices don't tell us. So one of those things is that, that the kind of the fundamental part of where you start thinking about forgiveness is what we call the injustice gap. So the injustice gap is a kind of a subjective amount of forgiveness, amount of injustice that I feel like I've experienced when somebody transgresses against me or offends me. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is we keep a kind of a running subjective tab on how much this injustice I perceive. So if a person, you know, if I say, hey, you hurt my feelings, and they say, yeah, life is full of little disappointments, isn't it? Well, you know, I may have had an injustice gap that was kind of moderate because of the hurt feelings, but once they reject, you know, that they did anything wrong, that increases the amount of injustice. Mm-hmm. But if I said, oh, it hurt my feelings, and they said, oh my gosh, I didn't understand, and, you know, and they're remorseful, and they're apologetic, and they offer to make amends, and, you know, every time they do one of those things, that reduces the amount of injustice that I perceive. And so that makes it easier to deal with the less injustice that I perceive.
Yeah, that's interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, it makes, you know, common sense, but until we started looking at it scientifically and developed a, you know, scale to measure how much injustice people felt, we couldn't really tell if that was just kind of common sense that might not be true, because a lot of common sense isn't, or whether that really did fit the way people experienced it. So that was one of the things that we found that we didn't anticipate. Another was all of those ways, other ways that are, you know, scripturally consistent ways of dealing with the injustice. You know, before, you know, you just think, oh, somebody hurt me, I need to forgive them. And it's like, well, no, you know, there's actually a lot more in the Bible about justice than there is about forgiveness. And there's about forbearance, and Paul treats that as something different than forgiveness. He says forgiving them and forbearing. So there are all these other ways that once we start thinking about this and turning it into something that we can measure and treat as a scientific fact, it expands our ideas of what, you know, I kind of have been the go-to common Christian understanding of what ought to happen, you know, if we are harmed. So those are two things that were unexpected. Another is just the amount of scientific evidence showing the benefits of forgiving. You know, that forgiveness has physical health benefits. We did an edited book in 2015, a whole book of people writing chapters about all the benefits of forgiveness in terms of physiology, you know, their stress hormones, the, you know, different problems that people have treated physically by forgiving. So there are physical health benefits. There's mental health benefits widely documented in terms of, you know, when we're unforgiving towards someone, we tend to ruminate about the wrong that was done to us and how much harm it did. And rumination is like playing things over and over in the Late Late Show of the Mind, you know, like a big B movie that's not very good. And so, but forgiveness really dampens out that rumination and helps us feel more closure on it. And therefore, we just don't ruminate as much. And so we don't keep making the hurt raw and green again by bringing it up in our minds again and again. So physical health and mental health benefits, and then of course relational benefits, because, you know, forgiveness, you know, helps us feel an urge to make the relationship right. Now, we use our you know, reason to, we may not act on that urge. You know, we don't have to reconcile with someone if it's not possible to reconcile, like they've died, you know, or if it's not really smart to reconcile, like, you know, this person has said they're going to kill me, so, well, I'm not going to reconcile with them, you know, because that's just not smart. So there are relational benefits, and then there are spiritual benefits to forgiving. So we know that, you know, Jesus said, you know, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, or forgive us, you know, our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And then he explained that one clause right there in the next two verses after the Lord's Prayer, where he said, for if you don't forgive those who trespass against you, your Father in heaven won't forgive you. But if you do forgive, your Father in heaven will forgive you. Now, you know, he's not talking about salvation-type forgiveness. He's not talking about justification. He's talking, you know, more about what, you know, in Paul calls the believer's judgment, you know. So this is not a matter of whether you're going to be saved. This is a matter of that our works are judged and burned up if, like straw and stubble and hay, if they are not glorifying to the Lord, but they are precious to the Lord, like diamonds and gold and silver, if they are holy, you know, works. So those works will be judged, you know, in the end, and whether there's lasting good to that.
Hey, so, Ev, I have a question. As you were talking about the emotional benefits when you forgive, I know that you say that there's two types of forgiveness, the decisional forgiveness, and then you go into the emotional forgiveness. And when you think back to the experience of your mother being murdered, did you start with decisional forgiveness, or were you already willing to do the emotional forgiveness? How did that come about?
So what we found by our research is there are these two types of forgiveness, and decisional forgiveness is to make a decision about how you want to act toward the person. Whereas emotional forgiveness is to replace negative, unforgiving emotions by positive, other-oriented emotions. Now, what the research shows is that those two are related to each other, but actually fairly weakly. That is, people often make a decision to treat the other person as a valued and valuable person and not get revenge on them. And yet they still are upset and emotionally hurt by the thing that was done to them. On the other hand, people will sometimes, you know, change their emotions toward a person and never make a decision to forgive. So, you know, for example, you know, if somebody, if I hurt somebody's feelings, and then, you know, they're sitting in their office looking out the window and they see me crossing the street and wham, I get hit by a car, breaks every bone in my body, and, you know, but I live, and, you know, they feel sympathy and compassion, you know, for me. And that, you know, amount of love and sympathy and compassion just, you know, obliterates this little grudge that they had. So they change their emotions to where they're not emotionally unforgiving toward me anymore. And yet they've never made a decision that they're going to treat me differently. So importantly, you know, these things can happen at the same time, or decisional can happen first, or emotional can happen first.
Right. Well, so Ev, let me ask you this question. This goes back to the injustice gap, because that's going to be, in the way I would see it, is that's going to be different person to person. And you mentioned two words: reason, which is our ability to think, and perception. You said perceive. Well, everybody looks at things differently, and they all have their own rules around these types of things. So if someone, you said they haven't made a decision, which that's the key to life in many areas. You have to make a committed decision to do whatever it is you're going to do. But do you believe the reason people won't make a decision to do whatever it is you're referring to is because they're programmed not to? In other words, they grew up in an environment where they saw their relatives or the people around them that acted, you know, contrary to what we would hold as maybe a more noble approach to forgiveness. Because some people, if you say one little thing to them that slights them, they might not, you know, they might hold a grudge for their whole life. Well, why is that? Versus someone who would just say, well, that's not really about me. That comment's about the person who made it, because in my mind, that is the truth. How do you look at that within your studies? What does your research tell you about that?
Yeah, I think there are personality differences, you know. So, for example, some people are just by disposition very agreeable. You know, they just get along with folks, and others are just disagreeable. And there's this kind of bell curve that goes all the way from terribly disagreeable to you know, hugely agreeable.
Right. And my question to you is, what do you think is What causes that? What's the factor involved and why one person's one way and the other one's the exact opposite, in your opinion?
Yeah. Well, let me just say that the other, you know, personality, you know, characteristic is called neuroticism or emotional reactivity. So some people are just very emotionally reactive and some people are not. So what causes those differences are, and you ask a psychologist this, you always get this answer, and that is, it's a combination of environment and genetics. So, you know, for some people, they have a very strong environment and, you know, maybe they're abused by, you know, someone. And so they grow up very sensitive to any kind of slight or hurt or threat. And this other person has a very benign environment and grows up, you know, without worrying about that. And so, you know, and then some people just by inheritance have a very reactive nervous system. You know, if you just suddenly clap your hands, some people will, you know, just kind of slowly look around at you and like, what's up? And others will just jump over the table when you clap their hands. So again, this is like a combination of what their environment was and what they're, you know, genetically kind of programmed by DNA to do. And, you know, people put those together in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Ev, I've got a question. As I'm thinking through some of these events, we're never able to prepare for the unthinkable of murder, suicide, you know. Did the study and your practice of being in this material, do you feel that it some way equipped you or, you know, gave you a different perspective to move through the experience? And if so, what was that for you?
Yeah, I think I looked back after this and I was able to forgive the young man who murdered my mom and to do so very quickly, which is not something usual. It's something very unusual, even for me.
Sure.
You know, I often say I had a professor who gave me a B and it took 10 years at a religious experience to forgive him. So I'm not really this super forgiver, but,
well, what do you think caused that, though, Ev? I mean, how were you able to forgive so quickly?
So, you know, looking back, I can give you a kind of, in retrospect, you know, analysis of it. Mm-hmm. But I think I applied a kind of a model that we were developing that we call REACH forgiveness. And so it's a kind of a 5-step model. So I did apply that model, but I think what really was working that helped me forgive quickly was I was very stirred up. I was very angry. And I was emotional in general. And once I started down the road of imagining what it must have been like for this young man to try to empathize, you know, that's the recall the hurt, then empathize with the person, that emotionality that I had got kind of transferred over into the empathy and into really a sense of guilt because I had stood in my brother's back room and pointed to a baseball bat and said, I wish whoever did that were here. I would take that bat and hit him in the head until he died. And so when I got to the point of thinking through empathically about this young man and what he had done, you know, and that he had hit my mom in the head because he's afraid that he's going to jail and his perfect crime is spoiled, and you know, I was empathizing with what he might have been feeling. And then suddenly juxtaposed against that, in opposition is me, a mature, at that time, 48-year-old man that was pointing to a baseball bat and willing to hit somebody in the head, until mm-hmm. they died. And I thought, well, whose heart is darker here? And, I thought, well, my heart is darker than this young man's heart. And yet I know I can be forgiven for this. And therefore, if I can be forgiven for the darkness of my heart, who am I to hold this against him? And that was kind of the turning point where I was able to forgive. And Kelly asked before, was this emotional forgiveness or was this decisional? And I think they both happened at the same time. It's like I made a decision not to treat this person as just his crime, but to treat the person as a valued and valuable person who had done a horrid thing. And I also had replaced that negative, unforgiving emotion by this stirred up sense of empathy and a sense of guilt by me and a sense of altruism that I wanted to give this young man a gift in the heavenlies, at least, that would free him. So I think that, that kind of all goes together. That's my after the fact analysis of this, of why it was able to happen so quickly when it doesn't always, and in fact, rarely does happen quickly. Usually it takes time to forgive.
Well, that is so powerful. It really is. But it's also a knowing that you had a high level of awareness to be able to think and to offer that level of compassion. And I would love for you to share. I know that, you were talking about your 5-step process called REACH. If you would share with the listeners, because maybe I believe that would be, an opportunity for them to grow, all of us, in our understanding of forgiveness.
Right. Well, because, and to add on to that, of what Kelly just said, the human emotion is natural in terms of just reacting, especially in this situation. So that I can totally relate to those feelings that you expressed there initially. But I believe, as Kelly said, it is through awareness that we're able to respond versus react. Because when we react, we give the person or the event the control. And when we respond, we maintain control.
But I want to go one more step further with this. Why I'm really resonating with that piece that you just shared. In the beginning, we started, someone has to be with a willing heart. And when my husband and I experienced our unthinkable, I did not have a willing heart to really use my perception to change my reaction at that time. Bob went to, like you said, the compassion. How did someone get to this space? I was not willing to go there just yet. It took me quite a bit longer, like you said, for some. And I know if I would have maybe been aware of the REACH process, maybe I would have been more open.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing we've learned is everybody is different. That's like wisdom of the ages, isn't it? Everybody's different. But, Mike McCullough, that the young man that really got me started on researching this, did a study in which he looked at people who had been hurt, and they were brought into the lab for 19 straight days and asked about their forgiveness. And what he found was a nice, smooth curve which showed that most people forgave within 3 days of, you know, they had just dropped down to about 20% of the unforgiveness. But, and then it kind of tailed off after that, and there wasn't much change per day. So that looks beautiful in a scientific paper, but Mike did a really interesting thing. He plotted individuals and how the individuals behave, and what you see from that was what is called in science a spaghetti plot, because it's just what everybody's individual trajectory was. Well, what you find is some people just got worse immediately, and it just maintained at a terrible level, and other people got worse slowly, and other people stayed pretty much the same, and other people got, you know, better slowly, and other people just, you know, got over it within a day. Now, the average is what the science shows, that nice smooth curve, but the reality of this is that everybody has got to, you know, wrestle with this individually, you know, before God, you know, and, you know, hopefully God, you know, creates a softness in us that helps us. But, you know I can be very resistant to what God wants for me, you know, and, you know, I think we all can at times. And so, you know, we just want to stay open to what God is doing in our lives. And we walk the path that our past and our present is leading us down. And sometimes that's right away a change, and sometimes it takes a while.
Yeah. No, that's great insight, Ev. I want to pivot to, just what we see almost, you know, unfortunately commonplace now today in the news. It seems like it's almost daily where, you know, communities are being constantly traumatized, you know, school shootings, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think about, like, how do you believe communities can become more forgiving as a whole? You know, and do you think that's possible? What would that look like after a traumatic event? Because, you know, some of these school shootings and things that are mass shootings that are going on, they're affecting more than just obviously the victims' families, but you know, it's systemic. It seems like today, what are your thoughts around that topic?
Yeah. Well, we know that communities can become more forgiving. And we know that because we've done 4 studies to try to run community awareness raising campaigns to help people, you know, develop forgiveness as a community. So 3 of these studies have been in Christian colleges. One of them has been in a secular university. And you know, what we know is that there are lots of things that can be done in a community that will help people raise their awareness of their need to forgive, show them how to forgive. So the last study we did was in this secular university in Colombia. There were 9,000 people in the community, and we tested 3,000 of them several times. And what we looked at was which kinds of community activities help people forgive. Now, this is really useful. This has been done in churches too, but we haven't published a study on it. But it could be in workplaces. It could be in, you know, any kind of community that's a closed community. But so we asked which kind of activity helped people forgive in Colombia. And what we found was that big, long activities, like participate in a 6-hour group, forgiveness group, they didn't help very many people because very few people were willing to devote 6 hours to try to forgive. Now, remember, we're talking about Colombia. We're talking about 60 years of civil war, mm-hmm. about child soldiers, about lots of traumatic events. So this is kind of serious trauma type forgiveness. We also found, though, that the things that were quick were very popular for people to do. Things like go to a forgiveness wall and write down, I want to forgive so-and-so for such and such a thing, and post it on the wall. Or go to a forgiveness tree and sit under the tree and think or pray for the person. People like to do those because they take about 10 minutes, but they did not produce much forgiveness. So it turned out that it was things that lasted about 1 hour to 3 hours that really were easy enough for people to participate in and yet strong enough for them to have an experience that actually changed them and helped them forgive. So one of those things was complete a 2 to 3 hour do-it-yourself workbook in forgiveness using this reach forgiveness method. But a couple of them were like attend lectures on forgiveness by a forgiveness expert or people who were experts in the community, the college community there. So I think my big takeaway is that you got to have to help communities forgive. You have to engage them enough that they spend time seriously trying to forgive. But the activities have to be pleasant enough and winsome enough that they're willing to do the activities and not just write them off as, oh, this will take too long. Yeah, I really could benefit by it, but it's going to take me 10 hours and I'm not going to do that.
Right.
So not sure I answered your question fully, but.
Yeah. Kelly, go ahead.
I just find that interesting. I was really listening to the activities that, you know, what is pleasant, something whimsical that could be engaging and inviting, and they're willing to participate. But so I was just there for a second. But I wanted to ask you, I saw where you had said, my salary has retired, but I haven't. And that I love that because it really tells me how passionate you are about this. And I guess my question to you is, what is your big idea moving forward? Like, what do you hope to do with your study, your specialized knowledge and expertise in this area?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. It's one that I ask myself about every day. So in a lot of ways, you know, I've published like over 500 papers in psychology, but one of the things that I think will end up being a contribution to, you know, world peace and Christian living is developing this reach forgiveness model. So that's been studied in over 30 randomized controlled trials throughout the world. And we just finished this huge study of almost 4,600 people in 5 countries, none of which is the U.S. But the reason I ask myself this is because, okay, so I've accomplished a lot with this. So what's left to accomplish? And what I'm finding is we got a lot of attention because of that study, and I just got off of the phone, or actually a Zoom meeting, and looking with a team of researchers who want to do a reach forgiveness study in 14 Arab Muslim countries.
Wow.
You know, so, yeah, I mean, wouldn't that be a great contribution? And that's not me doing the research, but that's them following on with, you know, these ideas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, me acting as a, just kind of giving them a practical advice about things that I've messed up before, and hopefully they won't mess up.
Right. Can I stop you right there? Because I want to go back to that. Yeah. But I just heard you say over 30 countries, but not in the United States. So what caused that, or why is that?
Yeah, that was, I probably misspoke, but it's over 30 randomized controlled trials. So probably 24 or so of those 30 were in the United States, and then six were in other countries.
Okay.
And then this big study is five non-United States studies. So it's like Hong Kong and the People's Republic of China, Indonesia, Ukraine, two sites in the Ukraine, Colombia, and South Africa. You can see all of those were your places where there's been substantial
imperialism,
violent conflict.
Yeah. What did the Ukraine, did that come up before the Russian invasion, or was this initiated after?
Well, it got started before the invasion, but it tended to get terminated by the invasion. Mm-hmm. Because one team was working nearer the contested areas, over in the Russian controlled areas, and one team was in Kyiv, and so Kyiv got attacked early on, and so that actually drove them out of the building that they were in, so that the people were, you know, using the building to house people who were injured. So that, you know, doing a scientific study in the midst of that, it had to end. They're just, you know, the priorities of keeping people alive were greater than doing research.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, that would be really interesting. I mean, there's, you know, it's, I just find it fascinating that, you know, somebody could look at some event and say, well, you know, this is how I would handle that. You know, I'd be able to forgive that. But this over here, well, that's totally different, you know, and I struggle with that as this my own self. You know, how would I, if my homeland was being invaded right now, I don't know if some of this stuff would just go out the window. I mean, you're obviously more in a survival mode. It's much different.
Right.
So our mind can only focus on one thing at a time. But I find that fascinating to see how that would unfold over. And there's many others that you've mentioned. Obviously the Middle East has been warring for centuries. So, yeah. So how has the scientific or the not the scientific, but the academic community responded to your work? Like, what, you know, how is that in your research into forgiveness? What have you seen there?
Well, I think starting about 1998, there started to be a lot of research on forgiveness. And it was really stimulated by Bob Enright at University of Wisconsin, and myself and Mike McCullough and Steve Sandage at VCU doing a lot of the initial research. But then the John Templeton Foundation put $3 million toward funding other research in forgiveness. And at that point, a lot of people who may never have considered doing research on forgiveness suddenly found that, you know, they could do studies that are good, big studies, because there was money. And that led to funding 20 major projects. And then, you know, I was executive director of a nonprofit called a Campaign for Forgiveness Research, and we raised another $6.4 million to fund research and forgiveness. And that stimulated a lot of additional research. So starting then about, 98, but really kind of flourishing about 2004, 2005, there suddenly were hundreds of studies on forgiveness. And it was well accepted by the, I think the scientific community, and that has just grown year by year by year, so that now, I think I read recently, somebody did a study and found over 3,600 studies on forgiveness.
Wow.
Or papers on forgiveness. So many of them had multiple studies. Mm-hmm. Whereas in 1998, there were 58 published studies on forgiveness.
Wow.
So
that's really,
you can see, it's huge. And I think what really helped was that a lot of people who were not religiously motivated did study forgiveness and started to show, hey, this works whether you're religious or not. This is mm-hmm. not something that the Christians own or the religious folks own. This is what we called in the first book that we wrote, to forgive is human. It's part mm-hmm. of God's general revelation. And that opened the door to have people who were not necessarily religious study it. And therefore, that opened it up to the whole scientific community and not just a kind of subpopulation of religious researchers.
So would you say it's safe to say that the science, there is one thing that science and theology agree on, religion agrees on today, that to forgive is, a healthy thing. It has obvious benefits. Would you say that both communities agree on that today?
Yeah, I would say that that is a general agreement, that there are obviously differences in the way that, people approach it, differences in methods that they use. But I think, the two, approaches, and it will include philosophy in that too. So, theology and philosophy and science all, kind of have a lot of agreement, a few differences that they can argue about, but, mostly pretty much on board with forgiveness is a good thing, and let's do it.
Let's do more of it. Yeah. So conversely, with your research and as Kelly said, your specialized knowledge in this area, when someone is unwilling to forgive for whatever reason, and in their mind, they're holding on to that and they've made it right or they've justified it, whatever the case is. I think we're all, we can all perceive and people understand in theory what the negative side effects of holding on to resentment and forgiveness are. But in your special opinion here, what would you say ultimately is going to be manifest in that person's life if they're unable to forgive?
Well, as I pointed out at the beginning, even if they're unwilling to forgive, there are lots of other ways to get rid of the injustices. And so they may be unwilling to forgive, but willing to work for justice, or willing to just forbear and let this take place, or just turn it over to God. Or, there are other ways to deal with it. But if they're going to hold on to emotional unforgiveness, then that's going to have mental health and physical health and probably relational and maybe spiritual consequences. So you know, and, you know, if you had another hour, I could detail.
I'm sure you could.
Well, that's another episode. We need to have you back on. This is everything you've been sharing is so fascinating, because it's one thing just to say, oh, I should forgive. And there's obviously a religious piece to where, you know, that's what I've been taught and, you know, but it's also another thing to completely understand the science behind what happens inside a person in regards to the emotions when they're holding on to this. So I have found all of this fascinating. I'm curious, obviously you've been in this material since I think you started in the 80s counseling, and then 90s you really started diving in to the science behind forgiveness. I always love to ask our guests, how would you define it? What does it look like and feel like to you? In a sentence, what would be your definition of forgiveness?
Well, I think there are two types of forgiveness. And so I don't like to think of the word forgiveness as having a definition. So one type is a decision to forgive. A decision to forgive is a decision to treat the other person as a valued and valuable person. So that's a decision. And then emotional forgiveness is the emotional replacement of negative, unforgiving emotions with positive, other-oriented emotions. And as I said, those are related to each other, but not joined at the hip. And there's no one order to take them in. They can happen at the same time, or either can happen before the other.
Well, as we are getting ready to close, I would ask, is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with?
Well, you asked earlier about that reach, what was involved in the reach model, and I never got around to naming the steps. So if I could just name
that'd be great.
The steps.
Yes, please do.
So, R is to recall the hurt, but not to just rehearse what a jerk the person was to hurt me or how much I've been damaged, but to rather recall it so that I empathize. So R is recall the hurt. E, empathize with the person who hurt me. That is, I try to get into their framework and see things from their point of view, which doesn't mean that they did it right or did anything right. It means I just can understand. And if that doesn't work, sympathize, feel compassion or love for the person. So R, E, A is then give an altruistic gift of forgiveness. It's altruistic because nobody deserves to be forgiven for hurting us. It's a gift we give and a choice we make. And then R, E, A, C is commit to the forgiveness that we experience. So that H, we can hold on to that whenever we doubt. Recall the hurt, empathize, altruistic gift of forgiveness, commit so that we hold on, reach.
I'm just writing that down. That's great. Okay. So recall the hurt, E is empathize, at least try to understand where that person was coming from. A is altruistic. It's a choice. It's a choice to forgive. And then C is commitment so that we can hold on when we doubt it.
Right. So, you know, I mentioned that 2.5 hour workbook. That workbook is available free to be downloaded in English, in Spanish, in Chinese, in Ukrainian, in Indonesian, reaching about 2/3 of the world's population in their first language. And that's totally free. for people to use at their leisure. The address of that is, of course, the https://, the usual suspects there. And then it's reach.discoverforgiveness.org. And people can download those workbooks free.
Okay, fabulous. And your website, Ev, is, could you tell the audience your website and where they can find more of your research?
Yeah, it's all free, except for the books. They won't let me give the books away, but, you know, I would if I could. But it's at evworthington-forgiveness.com. So that's evworthington-forgiveness.com.
Okay. There you go, audience. Ev Worthington. What a just fascinating and enjoyable conversation, Ev. Ev, we really, really enjoyed it today. And I'd love to have you back on because, as you said, we could talk for many more hours about this topic. And I love hearing your perspective and all your wisdom and just the research and the data and your findings behind it, because there's so much to this topic. And again, that's why Kelly and I began this journey, and I think, you know, what led us to want to start this podcast, Time for Forgiveness, because we all have a need to forgive in some way or some respect in our lives. So, yeah. Ev, we just wish you the best, and this sounds like you went through a little bit of a halftime, and now you're in the second half of your life, and you're going to do great things. So it's going to be exciting to see where you take it from here.
Yeah, Ev, I just, well, yeah. I really want to acknowledge you because I can hear and feel the passion that you have in regards to, you know, providing service and value to really make the world a better place. And I found this fascinating, and I so appreciate you sharing your time with us today.
Yeah, well, it was my pleasure. And thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, everyone, it was great to have you with us today for another great episode of Time for Forgiveness. If you, anybody in the audience, if you have a question on an upcoming episode you'd like us to address, please submit that at our website, which is www.timeforforgiveness.org. Make sure you like and subscribe on YouTube and follow along on our social media pages on YouTube and Instagram. And last but not least, if you have a personal story that you'd like to share, your journey through forgiveness that you feel could impact our audience and our community, we'd love to hear about it. And you can submit that through our website as well, timeforforgiveness.org. All right, we're going to wrap it up. And Ev, thanks so much again. And until we speak again, everyone, please live with passion and be safe out there. Thank you.